What's going on, everybody? It's your boy, Big Dave, back with the Bog. We're back after a long month of not being here. First of all, I'd like to apologize to everybody, all the Bog Lords out there. This has been a crazy holiday for me, and I just put a video on my YouTube, which just got demonetized, by the way, but I don't care. Screw them. We had a baby over the holidays, and then around New Year's, my whole family contracted COVID, so we were really struggling with that, and we were very, very sick, and we're still pretty sick, but we're getting over it now, and we're back in business, and we got more Bog coming, we got more content coming for all the patrons, and all that good stuff. So I just wanted to apologize from bottom of my heart to you guys for not being around for like a whole month. I was sick as a dog. My whole family was sick, and we had a little screaming newborn baby and no sleep, and there was just craziness. It was really bad, but if you want to hear about my experience with COVID, go over to my YouTube channel. I just uploaded a video talking about it, but anyway, thank you guys for tuning into the Bog. We're back riding shotgun with me. I got the Wolfman and Andre from Norway. Unfortunately, Mr. Tristan isn't feeling good himself, so it's just us. It's just the three of us. It's a ladies' night with the boys. I guess. Ladies night.
Wait, what?
hey, I've been
that's
diseased.
Pretty low-key.
Yeah.
There, dude.
All right. It's going to be a nice night. That's all I'm saying here. We're going to get the candles out. We're going to have some wine. It's going to be a special night with Dave and Wolfman and Andre from Norway. Don't worry. It's nothing ergy.
This is escalating way too quickly.
Yeah.
Dave's wearing his prettiest dress just for tonight.
This is for you guys. I got all prettied up. I'm on camera for everybody. But anyway, make sure to go to facebook.com/Iron Age Jyotish to check out some authentic Vedic astrology. I'm telling you, this stuff is so cool. So make sure to go over, check out Neil John at facebook.com/Iron Age Jyotish and get yourself a reading. If you decide to get a reading over there, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. And if you support the Bog, you want to see the Bog grow, you want to continue our ambitions and support us, keep lights on, go to patreon.com/thebog. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50, and you can get an RSS feed for the audio of every single program that we do, so you can listen to in your car, on your commutes, at work, or at the gym. But if you want to support the Bog one way and get some sweet Bog merch, you can go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and make sure to get a t-shirt, get a hoodie. There's dresses for the ladies. There's insulated coffee mugs. There's all kinds of whatever merch you could think of. Artisan chef aprons, so when you get your bloat and you got your Vesla going, you got your boys and your kinsmen over and you're cooking and you want to show off your Bog stuff, you just go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop if you want to support us, help us keep the lights on with some sweet Bog merch. So, anyway, tonight we are going to talk about the Jotnar. We're going to talk about the giants, and this is a topic that's really fascinating, and it's a topic that there's a lot of debate about. And our boys Wolfman and Andre have quite a bit of notes, and we're going to talk all about the Jotnar and who the Jotnar are. Are they good? Are they bad? Are they all bad? Are they destructive forces of nature? Is it a mixed bag? Who are they? What do they do? Why are they different? Why do the gods fight them? So anyway, let's get right into it. Mr. Wolfman, Mr. Andre, how are we doing tonight?
Doing pretty well.
Oh, doing pretty good.
Good stuff. Excellent. So, Mr. Wolfman, let's get right into it. Who are the Jotun? Who are they?
Well, the Jotun, or I guess I should start with a small disclaimer. I think something that's important for us as a spiritual community, and even outside of that, but just as researchers and academics and such, we should probably try to make the effort to refer to them as the Jotun or the Jotnar rather than giants, because it gives people, especially people unfamiliar with the source material, the idea that they're all, you know, like Jack the Giant Slayer type, you know, giant humanoids, when, you know, they could be the size of a man, they could be ugly and monstrous, they can be fair and beautiful. Like, they really are a very mixed bag as far as entities go. And they are, I would guess, the oldest tribe, so to speak, of entities, which, you know, would include the Aesir, the Vanir, the Elfar. But they are the tribe most associated, of course, with destruction and chaos and things we would call evil and malice and whatnot, because their role has always kind of been to be the force of antagonism, to be the counterpull to the Aesir and, you know, the forces of order and, you know, good, so to speak.
Sure. So why is it that calling them a giant is inaccurate?
Just because the translation, you know, it's kind of a mistake lost literally in translation, whereas the English, giant very much denotes something that is very large. And it kind of arises specifically from a lot of the stories of giants being, larger than life, like Skrymir, the guys taken on by Utgard Loki, Thrym, the Asi. Like, most of these entities are described as being huge because, you know, they're powerful enemies that one of the gods, usually Thor, has to overcome and conquer and defeat. But then there are others who, really, there is no description in the lore or in any accompanying material to suggest that they look overly different than the Aesir or the Vanir, like Freys or any of the number of giantesses or Jotnaresses that are married by the Aesir or the Vanir. They're often described as, you know, being rather beautiful. Even like Gerd, the wife of Freyr, she's described as being a cold beauty in the sense that maybe she's not the most friendly or warm soul, but still a beautiful thing unto itself, rather than the monstrous form of like Fenris or his siblings or like the troll wives and the Ironwood and whatnot. Yeah. But regarding their specific origins, that's kind of more Andre's thing. He's the primordialist between us.
Let's hear it, Andre.
Andre?
Well, yeah. Just as a little bit of a side note, is that there's actually a term for a female Jotun, and it's a Giger. Gia is the term that's used for female Jotuns. But when talking about the Jotuns, what you say as them being the primordial tribe would be very true because of the primordial creation of the Jotun and the primordial creation of the gods are tangentially very related to each other. They are very interconnected. And I'm sure most people would be familiar with the creation myth, the creation story, as is, you know, it's one of the more famous ones. But just to like shortly recap, is that the first beings that came into existence upon this, I wouldn't say Earth, but like in existence, the two first creatures in existence was a cow, the primordial cow, Audhumla, and the primordial giant, Ymir.
Yep.
And it's from Ymir where the tribe of the Jotuns come from, where he gave birth, kinda, to the Jotuns from his armpits. And also in other the related stories, his legs.
It's feet specifically, actually.
Jotuns. Huh?
I didn't mean to overrule you, but it's his feet. And actually, on that note, I wanted to add that it seems that the lineage of Jotun that become, you know, Odin and his brothers, those are the ones derived from his armpits.
Yes.
Whereas it seems that the more sinister tribe, you know, the ones that ultimately descend into Loki and his kin, those are the ones that come from the foot, the mating of the
Yes. feet. To just recap it somewhat shortly, the first male and the first female giant came from his armpits. And the cow, Audhumla, was licking the salty rocks in primordial creation and after a while uncovered a head. And after a longer while, uncovered a body. And this turned out to be the first of the tribe of the gods called Buri. And Buri married one of the Jotuns and gave birth to a son, Bur. And Bur married another Jotun called Besla and gave birth to Odin and his siblings. Odin and his siblings were then the ones that were the ones that ended up being the bane of Ymir, where Ymir was slain by them and the entire world, the realms were created from his body. And
now here's something
during this period, this flood.
I think we have a little bit of a delay or something like that, but that's okay. So, one thing that some people will say, oh, the gods are bad for killing Ymir and like all this stuff, and you know, because from these Jotun, you know, Bori and Bestla are born Odin, Hainir, and Lothor, who then go on to create man. But they say some people will make the argument, well, the gods don't always do good things because they killed Ymir. Ymir is not really a conscious entity. Ymir is a I believe it describes him as this like mindless yawning entity. He's not really a conscious entity.
Well, he's almost kind of, if you'll pardon the parlance, he's almost kind of like the void made manifest into creation, in the sense that, and this is kind of where, you know, people would say too, oh, well, based on his lineage, Odin's technically a Jotun. So, you know, this whole Aesir Jotnar antagonism is hypocritical, blah, 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 like those Lokean dung heaps. But the thing is, and it's not really expressly stated so much as it's just kind of heavily implied and left up to your own common sense. But given that Odin and his brothers, and you know, the more sinister tribe of Jotnar, they both come from Ymir, albeit different parts of Ymir, that, you know, that they somehow would have to share in nature because of that shared origin. But we can clearly see that Odin and his brothers are, you know, they're against chaos, they're against void. They want to take the primordial nothingness and shape it into order and light and good things. Whereas, you know, the other side of that, the other tribe kind of prefers that primordial chill and dark, which is why you get those really weird cringe strains of Thursatru people who quite literally say they worship the Jotun because they want destruction and chaos, because they want existence to return to, you know, the great nothing of the primordial void, Ginnungagap.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. But so because of that distinction, I think it's rather implicit that Odin and his brothers, even if they have shared origins, are very different than the children of Ymir's feet, which we'll get into later.
Well, I just want to like say that, you know, also like I agree with here with like what Dave said, is that Ymir is not really portrayed as something that's entirely sentient. Like, he feeds off the cow to grow to an enormous size, but it doesn't seem to do much other than that. So he's like the manifestation of a primordial chaos, a primordial nothingness given form, and it was from this nothingness where the realms were born, when the creative forces of the gods decided to create the world out of his body. Even in some cases, I guess you could speculate that maybe Ymir wasn't... He might have been somewhat sentient, but he might have been cruel. He might have been unjust and generally just chaotic. So his death would be not just justified, but in many ways necessary for the continuation of the void.
I've read, and I forget what the source was or what the translation was, but I've read that Ymir, as you say, was inherently not evil, but just kind of like devouring and hungering, kind of. Yes. And I think the implication there is that, like, you know, we just kind of agreed, he's not really conscious in the sense that like Odin would be or one of these other entities, but he's just kind of this great devouring force. He is like primordial chaos, primordial void given form. Entropy. And from that primordial void, you know, the gods make things out of it. And so in a way, this is why it's kind of fun when like the scientific determinalists and materialists get all, oh, religion is dumb because science. And then you kind of point out that the most widely accepted scientific theories for the origin of the universe just sound like very literal, non-poetic descriptions of exactly what is in our theology.
Yeah.
Because like Andre and I have talked about this before, but like the whole Big Bang, you know, like matter out of nothing, it all sounds very much like, you know, the primordial void, you know, the fires of Muspelheim and the ice and mist of Niflheim combine, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of fun to get them with that whole thing, that our creation story really doesn't contradict established science at all.
Yeah, it's we've already known about the Big Bang. You know, I mean, we knew about the creation. That's our cosmological argument, is understanding that there is a point of creation. Now, going back to, you mentioned something that's really important with understanding the Jotnar, and that is Ymir and all of his children, they are very much into consumption. They are very much into devouring. They are, every story of, not all of them, because obviously some marry into the gods and some are seemingly kind of neutral and not bad at all, but how many stories do the Jotnar appear and they're drinking or they're eating and they're this undisciplined,
or chasing, really,
or yeah, and they are just these undisciplined forces of desire and hunger and thirst, and they have no bottom to it, and they are very much just entities of entropy.
Well, I think the interesting thing there, like you mentioned, about how there are some that are, you know, not evil, that marry in with the gods and whatnot, it almost seems like it's an expression of the civilizational power of the gods, in the sense that, like, here you have beings that are primordial, chaotic, all the things we've been saying, but then, you know, they marry into the Aesir, and then they're maybe not benevolent necessarily, like Gerd is not, again, not the warmest or friendliest of souls, but they're not evil or they're not antagonistic. So there's definitely an interaction of forces between order and chaos, between the Aesir and the Vanir and the Jotnar, that plays into how their relations all work out.
Well, in a way to summarize this, I guess you could say that the Jotnar, in many ways, are representation of a lot of the forces of nature, and nature itself is one of unceasing conflict, its unceasing consumption for the sake of your own preservation. It doesn't know self-discipline necessarily. Well, just like, for instance, a wildfire will consume and consume and consume until it extinguishes itself.
Well, it's like you mentioned with Ymir, basically his existence being to be fed by the primordial cow. Ymir doesn't have a conscience. He doesn't really have a will. He just exists to consume, which, like we've been saying, is kind of the underlying theme of all the Jotnar. And as Dave was saying, they're usually depicted as feasting or drinking, but also of coveting. They're always chasing after something, if it's the sun and the moon in the sky, or a goddess that they want to marry, or they covet a treasure, like, you know, Thor's hammer or Freya herself. They covet, they pursue. They're very predatory by nature. They're very much the undying quest to consume and devour and destroy. And it's not really because they are malevolent per se, it's that they are malevolent because that is their nature.
Well, yeah, and this is often portrayed in different types of Jotuns, where they are almost single-mindedly obsessed with certain things. But one specific thing comes to mind is, for instance, the giant called Logi in the story of Utgard Loki, with, you know, Loki and Thor and all those, is that Logi is the personification of fire, and he's a personification of fire as a Jotun, and he just devours and devours and devours and devours. That's his role. He devours everything. It doesn't matter what it is, he just devours. That's his role. And like many other Jotuns, they have almost single-minded roles that they fulfill, be that they covet, as you say, goddesses they want to marry, or specific objects, or even things like coveting knowledge and wisdom. Like, some Jotuns are almost single-mindedly obsessed with collecting and safekeeping knowledge in a very selfish manner.
Well, you know, what's funny is it is selfish in a lot of cases, but then in some cases too, it almost seems maybe not benevolent, but like, Their desire to consume and to gather and chase ends up taking on the form of like the really zealous librarian, almost like Mimir, you know, those other Jotnar that even Odin will go to consult for their wisdom. And it's like their need to, it's almost Tzeentian, right? Like the need to understand, the need to have all the knowledge and information possible.
Yeah. It's
so I guess Mark Zuckerberg might in fact be a Jotnar.
It's very much this force of unbridled desire. And that is what, to me, when I read about the, and here's another thing we have to remember when we're reading the text. When you read a story, when you read stanzas in the Eddas, there's never one way to interpret that. There's always many layers and many ways of interpreting it. This is something we run into a lot. So when once in a while, like we'll talk about, and Ian mentioned a few times some of his ideas, his interpretation of, he believes that this is also representing like directions and cycles of civilization and so on and so forth. That doesn't just mean that. That could absolutely mean that. But it also could be taken literally. It also could be a representation of something in nature. It could be demonstrating something ritualistically. It could be transformative. It could be, there could be 100 ways, 100 layers of interpretation that goes on with these texts. So I don't want anybody to ever think that there's only one way to interpret a single stanza. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, our ancestors were a very, very poetic and artistic people. And the thing to keep in mind is that a lot of this material was written or compiled with the knowledge or the assumption that most of the audience would already be decently familiar with the figures and stories inherent. So it's less of a narrative and more of a, a poem, more of a piece of art that we have to glean narratives from. But yeah, I mean, lost in time, lost in compilation, lost in different translations and whatnot. There's a lot of poetry and a lot of art, and art fundamentally is kind of subject to the eye of the beholder. So there will be different translations. There will be different interpretations. But at the end of the day, it's just important to kind of not dwell too much into like UPG territory, which isn't bad in and of itself, but don't be dissuaded or discouraged by the fact that sometimes artistic presentation can make things murky or confusing.
Yeah, and we also have to keep in mind when we're reading this in English, we're getting like 10% of the story. When in the Old Norse text, when you read it, a lot of times somebody's name will be half of the story in itself, and we lose that. We lose a lot of that. A lot of times there's words that are put into place a certain way that are meant to give an emphasis. And then there's going to be metaphors and cultural cultural flavor that put on to these sentences, like expressions that no longer exist that are only in archaic language, like, sometimes Odin is referred to as the Herjafuller, which means the Herja father, and that means father of hosts. And I've read for many, many years that this is talking about, because also in the Havamal, it talks about being a good host, like having people over to your house. Oh. And here in modern English, when you say host, it means two things: hosting a party or like the host of a parasite. However, in archaic language, host means army. Host is like an army.
Yeah.
So when you say Herjafuller, what that means is the grand general of all armies.
Well, even now in modern German, the name of the army is the Heer, because it's the same root word. So like that title of Odin's pretty much means warlord, more or less, army lord.
Yeah. So that's just an example. So back to the Jotnar. Now that we understand kind of their nature and what they are, and they're not necessarily always evil, and to put this out there, evil is a concept that we understand, but can understand that evil in the Germanic theology is more in common with adharmic, something that is not in line with natural law, something that is against Urlaug,
right.
And something that... Go ahead.
I was going to say, which is Gulveig's principal sin, is that she goes specifically to cause trouble and strife by corrupting all the works of the gods, all that is natural and orderly, and she goes specifically to spite them.
Exactly. And we say this, but I think we say this every single episode, natural law, like natural law is not tooth and claw. Natural law does not mean what animals do. Natural law is what the universe rewards to be as good.
Well, something to add there is that natural law, like for animals, is tooth and claw because they're animals, but we are not. Like, yes, mankind is mammals, blah, 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 all that stuff. But the gods, by uplifting us from the primordial ooze and, you know, from Heimdall traveling amongst us and all that, gave us a nature above that. You know, we are more than Fang and Claw. As much as I love Jack London and his books, we're more than that because we've been uplifted, because we have that breath, that Ulthar from Odin. Actually, so Dave, were you going to go somewhere with that? Because I was kind of interested in talking about the origins of Loki and how he connects to Odin.
Now go right ahead.
Ah, yeah. So Andre kind of got through the origins of Odin and, you know, his particular tribe of Jotnar. But then, you know, the other question is, where do the really bad ones come from? And, you know, we all know Loki is the father of lies and just kind of a general bad dude. So the feet of Ymir were, according to the, I think, Poetic and Prose Edda both, but Snorri, I think, wrote it in his foreword or something like that, that from Ymir, who's also named Arglmir by Snorri, he fathered the six-headed giant from his feet mating, which was Thridgilmir, in Old Norse, which is a name that means like strength yeller or strong yeller. And you'll note too, a lot of these Jotnar, they have names related to loud noises, loud, chaotic things, you know. So strength yeller for Thridgilmir. And then his son, who is Bergelmir, which is, you know, mountain yeller or bear yeller, who's the original Frost Jotun and the son of the previous one. And he was actually kind of the progenitor of the second generation of Frost Jotun, because after Odin and his brothers killed Ymir and there was the flood of his blood, the survivors of that were Bergelmir and his unnamed wife, who went on to repopulate, you know, the Jotnar race, more or less, or tribe, so to speak. But then his son, Bergelmir, that is Farbauti, which means dangerous or angry striker. And some scholars stip in that this is basically a byname or a title for like lightning, especially because Loki's mother's name is Laufey, which is kind of a word for like brush or like, you know, plants. And so the idea is that, you know, when lightning joins with, you know, brush, then you have Loki, which is, you know, fire. But that's kind of a loose etymological thing that I don't want to get too much into. But the thing with that is that he's the father of Loki. So Loki's kind of descended from these, paternally, this primordial frost giant lineage. But then his mother is the daughter of Forn-Jotr, who is also another primordial giant, but he's the father of several other famous, Jotuns. And I'm doing that thing I said not to do where I'm calling them giants. I apologize. Gaimir and Aegir are both sea Jotun and they're sons of, Forn-Jotr. And then there's Logi, who Andre already mentioned is presumably a fire Jotun. He's the personification of fire. And then there's Kari, which is, I subsume that there's a, you know, I guess we could call it a storm Jotun in the sense that they're associated with weather, particularly bad weather, and specifically singing songs or chants that make the weather turn bad to, you know, mess with the gods, mess with mortals, etc. But that's also regarded as the personification of wind. So from that primordial giant kind of come these other primordial elemental beings that all have their own personifications and natures. But so from those two lineages comes Loki, and Loki is initially, as everyone kind of, I think, would know, taken in by the Aesir because of his, you know, good ties with Odin. But over time, because his quote-unquote jokes and pranks get deadlier and nastier, he wears out his welcome and is banished. So in a way, it's almost like Loki and Odin, their bond at first is kind of like almost like a reunion of the two, you know, strands of Jotnar from Ymir, almost in kind of a parallel way, the way that Baldur and Hode would return to, you know, rule over an age of peace after Ragnarok, kind of in a conciliatory kind of way.
They're like a duality.
Yeah. But like just that their union as friends or whatever you want to call it represents the fact that, like, you know, creation can exist because, and, you know, things from opposing forces are now reconciled and together in kind of a back of the woods philosophical kind of way. So from there is where you have Loki. And as an aside, God of War, the one that came out a couple of years ago, that as a side note, I hate because I find it kind of blasphemous because I don't like killing gods and stuff, even if it's video games. But I was watching my cousin play it, and I'm kind of digging the new theme and stuff. And the kid, whose name is Atreus, I note the entire game because I was like visiting my family, and my cousin was all into it because it had just come out. And I'm watching it, and I'm like, this kid is like getting increasingly dark and like just snobby, and like I don't like this kid. Something's off about him. And then I kind of made the connection one day because I walked in and my cousin was talking about it because I missed a cutscene or something. And he was saying that that the kid's mother is a giantess named Fae. And I just kind of sat there and I was like, Fae, a giantess named Fae. Why does that sound familiar? And I thought, oh, maybe it's like, you know, a pop culture reference to Laufey, like, you know, Loki's mom. Then I thought, wait a minute. If that's Loki's mom and that's the name of this kid's mom in this game, and the kid's dad is Kratos, a.k.a. the God of War dude, who's very much would fit the description of the name Dangerous or Angry Striker. And then I had that like light bulb moment of those clever bastards. They literally took the Loki's parentage and like disguised it like that. And I told my cousin that, and he's like, I don't know, man. I think they just pulled the names for creative use. And then like the next day he beat the game and he's like, you're never going to guess. I was like, no, I did guess. I was right. I just thought that was kind of a, as much as I disdain a lot of Nordic pop culture references, I thought that was kind of a witty insertion.
And then, you know, I don't know if I'd feel comfortable playing as a Lokian character killing the gods. That would really rub me wrong.
I think they're setting it up so that in the future, Kratos kind of realizes that his kid's not very good and he ends up like repenting and changing sides. I don't know. That's just that's I guess what I hope happens, because screw Loki and Lokians, but you know, who knows?
Yeah. So getting back to Loki himself and his origins, you know, you mentioned how he at first is, you know, friends with Odin. And then over time, you mentioned how his, you know, pranks get worse and worse and worse to the point that they give him one of the harshest punishments anybody's ever had. You know, they bind him up in Niflhel with his mouth sewn shut, and you know he's there, you know, forever until Ragnarok.
By the entrails of his own son, I might add.
Yeah,
his own son's intestines are his binds.
That's how evil this guy is. And you know, it's not about. Mark Perrier makes a really good comparison. He says Loki is not the funny cool trickster and like everybody laugh. Loki is the school shooter. Loki is a sociopath. Loki is yeah. he hates Baldur, so he conspires to have him killed and frame somebody else.
It wasn't like a happy accident. He legitimately hated and was jealous of Baldur. And kind of the school shooter thing, that's a good comparison, because I was just thinking Loki isn't like that funny prank guy that took it too far. Loki is literally that weird, you know, trench coat kid that if you don't laugh at his joke, he's going to come shoot you.
Yeah, he's...
And his joke is like throwing a cat out of a window or something.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. He's mean-spirited. He's spiteful. He's narcissistic. He's a rotten, black-hearted, evil entity that still...
He's a pathological liar at that. He's always slandering the goddesses and mocking the gods and stuff.
He speaks lies. He fathers monsters. You know, I mean, what is there to like about this guy?
Well... On the subject of his children, I understand that they're, by their very nature, they're chaotic and enemies of the gods and stuff. But I've talked about this with Tristan and Andre before, but I can't help but feel a degree of sympathy for some of these entities, particularly Fenrir and Hel, in the sense that, yeah, they're not good dudes or whatever, but you don't really get to help who your parents are and what your nature is. And so it's almost more like Loki's an ass for bringing them into existence to begin with, rather than them being, you know, crappy on their own. And Fenrir in particular, I find it interesting that he's almost accepted among the Aesir until he starts to grow far too large and until Odin has the prophecy that Fenrir will devour him. Because up until that point, he almost seems to be treated like a guest, you know, in Asgard. And that Tyr almost seems to be like his handler, like his friend in a sense. And that's why Tyr, you know, in addition to being the bravest of the gods, is the only one who Fenrir trusts to, you know, put his hand in his mouth while he's being bound. And so from my perspective, it's like I understand Fenrir would grow too large and grow unruly and destroy and devour Odin, all those bad things. But standing aside from that, it just seems like a raw deal that because your dad sucks, you have to, and because you can't stop growing, that you have to be bound in this magical, you know, binding that'll, you know, take forever to break, if not like, you know, a more or less an eternity.
Yeah,
the person who tricked you into doing it was, you know, the one of them that you kind of liked. So from that, I kind of, you know, pity him in a bit. And hell too almost reminds me of like a sickly unwanted child. So,
and we talked about this, about there's some things that are just inescapable, like Fenrir. You're talking about Fenrir, and you have some pity for him and stuff like that. I compared this to Jeffrey Dahmer, and talking about guys like Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey Dahmer was not, you know, he was born that way. He was born with the genetic predisposition to be evil. He was born with those things. And then he goes into a family that's very neglectful and rotten, and he had a really bad mom. He was like literally he was a monster. He was born to be a monster. And the first guy that he killed, and you know, he did all that really sick, disgusting stuff. He hit him in the head with a weight, with like a dumbbell or whatever. When he went to jail, and when he died, somebody hit him in the head with a weight. And it showed on the autopsy, he didn't even put his hands up to defend himself. He let this guy kill him, probably because he knew in his heart that he was a monster and he deserved this ending. It was a, you know, poetic justice for him to be whacked the way that he whacked the first guy that he did and did all that sick, disgusting stuff. So you can look at Fenrir the same way you look at someone like Jeffrey Dahmer, or somebody like another thing I brought up when we had that conversation was Lenny from Of Mice and Men. Lenny didn't know how strong he was. He didn't understand. He didn't understand what that lady was trying to do to him when she put herself on him. He didn't understand when he killed the little rabbits or their kittens or whatever they were. But at the end of the story, Lenny had to die. He didn't understand. It was just in his nature to be that way. He was, you know, slow and too strong for his own good. But unfortunately, George had to put him down because that was his fate. So when we look at entities like Fenrir, yes, we can look at him and we can say it sucks that he was born into this. It sucks that he's a monster by nature, but he must be bound because he is a destroyer.
Although the interesting thing about Fenrir specifically is he's not really described as a threat or being very dangerous prior to that. It's specifically because of the prophecy of him devouring Odin that he must be bound, which in a way almost gets you to wonder, is it a self-fulfilling prophecy? But then given if your father is Loki and your mother is Gullveig, you probably never stood a chance of having a moral bone in your body. But do we want to get into the different types of giants now?
Yep, or
different Jotun? I just did it again.
Let's do it.
All right, Andre, you want to start with the Frost and Sea Jotun then?
Yeah, sure. One common name that you often see used when describing Jotuns is, of course, giant, but they're also usually conflated with this idea of being Rimtussar, or frost giants, or rime giants, as they're more properly called in Norse. And I don't think this is necessarily an accurate catch-all term for all different types of Jotun, as much as a specific grouping of Jotun, specifically those who dwell in Niflheim, the primordial realm of ice and frost. Simultaneously, you also got a lesser-known specific type of giant that I guess could be classified as ocean giants or sea Jotun. It's not necessarily named in the source, but there are several Jotuns who are described as having a close affinity with the sea, specifically with the depths of the sea and the nature of the ocean itself, and things like wind, which would come from the sea, like coastal regions are more prone to wind and so forth.
Well, not to cut you off too much, but then there's that reoccurring theme of like darkness and cold, right? Because the depths of the sea, the depths of, you know, a deep lake are dark and cold, and Niflheim and, you know, Rime Jotun are inherently associated with primordial dark and cold.
Well, yes, I guess in this way you could also connect it to like frost and ice giants being connected to, well, ice, which thawed becomes water. So this idea that the ocean being as cold and as unwelcoming as it is might be the realm of frost giants or ice giants, or it might be a specific realm of ocean giants themselves. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is when it comes to ocean giants, it would be Ægir and Ran, which are commonly accepted amongst the gods as being part of their own kind of. They are giants. They're not gods. They're not the, they're not part of the Æsir or the Vanir. Like, Njord is a Vanir, but he is definitely of a divine lineage. Ægir is called the Lord of the Sea, or often God of the Sea, but that might not be entirely accurate, as he might be more of a personification of the sea itself. And...
Yeah, his brothers are his brothers are, as I mentioned before, the personifications of fire and wind. So I think you're very accurate in that.
Yeah, so they might be more like primordial elements, like representation of the primordial elements of fire, water, and wind.
Now, well, you said real quick, Andre. I'm sorry, I gotta. You mentioned about how he's inaccurately described as a god. Let's keep in mind, a lot of people will just throw that word "god" around, and they think it means any sort of, you know, powerful entity. But in actuality, the word "god" comes from the word "golden," and "golden," like "region," and like are both the word "golden" specifically talks about the Æsir gods. The Æsir are the gods. Nobody else are gods.
Well, yes.
God is also like the ones you actually worship and pay reverence to. Like, even if you acknowledge like there's different divine tribes of the Æsir, the Vanir, Elfar, Jotun, because the Æsir and the Vanir, and maybe to a lesser extent the Elfar, are the ones you actually venerate and honor and they give a shit about you or care about you, it's those are the gods. Even if there are Jotnar who are of similar origins or power or whatever comparison you want to use, they're not the gods because they're not, you know, figures of order and civilization and vanguarding humanity and creation, et cetera, et cetera.
I agree with that. I mean, that's obviously true. I just, you know, God is not a function word. Or it's a title. It's a surname.
Yes, in that's why I wanted to bring it up. Why I said it was somewhat inaccurate to kind of call him like a god, because there is a bit of a scholarly kind of debate and discussion going around this, where you have these different words to describe something, because the mythological and historical studies in modern academia and so forth usually conflate the idea of a god to be a ruler of a specific thing, like an element of some sort, while in traditional Norse society, like, you know, the idea of Godin would be like something like, you know, the Æsir, or, you know, I guess in some cases the Vanir as well. So there's a bit of a confusion between the two languages here, what the idea of a god means. So this idea that Ægir, being a Jotun of the sea, kind of controls the sea, doesn't necessarily means or makes him a god of the sea or the ocean itself. That would be more the realm of Njord, per se. That's why I said it was more that he was a representation of the power and the realm of the sea itself, while not necessarily being, I guess, the ruler of it. I guess in a way he's a ruler of the sea, but that still doesn't make him a god. He is conflated amongst the gods. He is a friend of the gods, as, you know, it's kind of portrayed several times that, you know, Ægir throws some hells of parties in his hole in the sea, but
I don't think that means he's necessarily a friend, though. I think, you know, back in the day, I mean, kings and lords, like in the migration era, used to hold lavish feasts and banquets for people that they hated just because it was a expected formality of culture. Like, so for example, given Ran and her whole disposition and the fact that I think it's the same figure as Gulvig / Angerboda, very much so, I get the sense that Aegir's feasts are compelled rather than freely and wantonly given.
Well, I guess in this case, I shouldn't be using it necessarily use the word friend, but like more compatriot.
Associate,
compatriot, something like that. Basically, he's somewhat of an ally to the Azir, while his wife also fulfills a role in the mythology itself as being the caretaker and the capturer of those who drown at sea, where she casts her net and captures them and pulls them to her hall.
Caretaker is kind of heavy, though. It's more that she captures them, like collecting them.
I was getting to that because it's an interesting thing to note that the word Ran means robbery.
Yeah, she's robbing you of your life and stealing you for her own hall because she's jealous of Odin and the other halls, like Folkvanger and Valhalla.
Yeah, she's interpretation. Forcibly capturing people who drown at sea to pull them into her hall.
Yeah. Well, then, too, just real quick before I forget, the issue of what are gods and what aren't isn't really dependent on what, genus or tribe they're part of. Because, within the gods, you have the Aesir, obviously. You have the Vanir. But then you also have some Jotun, like Skathi, for example, probably most notably.
Who's married in.
So, right. But and then it also shows the importance of the reconciliation and power of marriage alliances. But the point is that
the term God is very much 100% dependent on tribal alliance. You don't become a god unless you are counted among the Aesir. And I actually, I don't see a strong differentiation between the Aesir and the Vanir. I think that they're the... the same entity, the same ruling powers.
As part of the same pantheon for sure. But the Vanir are definitely correlated more to like water and earth, whereas the Aesir are more, sky gods in a sense. I don't know if you meant it like that though.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, when it comes to the term god, a god is somebody that is married into, born into. Is part of the pantheon, part of the family of the Allfather. Yeah, that's why I don't. Loki is not a god,
right? Like, to use a comparison to like the Greeks, like the Vanir, Aesir, and even a Jotnar like Skathi, they're all Olympian, so to speak. They're all part of the same pantheon that we honor and respect and worship and whatnot. They're not like determined by their genus or tribe, whatever.
But they are determined by their tribe.
But they're not ground into it by their very existence. For example, the giantess is marrying into the Aesir and whatnot.
But once they marry into the Aesir, they become part of the gods.
But they're still Jotnar and they're referred to as such.
But they kind of, they surrender their previous identity.
I get your
identity point,
but they're still originate from the same line as the other Jotun, and they're still part of the Jotun.
Well, I have to agree with Dave.
I don't
want
the word race, but...
Like, I have to agree with Dave here. In this case, like, the tribal allegiances and the tribal alliances that were forged was basically if you were part of one tribe and you married into another tribe... Because you married someone from the other tribe, you become part of that tribe.
That's literally what I started my last little speech with, but all right.
So, okay. The innate nature might not necessarily matter as much. So, like, Skadi might still technically be considered a giant, but she's still married into the realm of the gods, so she's technically considered a goddess.
That was kind of my point, Andre.
Yeah. All right, we're all in agreement, then. That's all good. We have, like, 9 minutes left, so let's do one more topic.
I don't think I have time for the Ironwood with 9 minutes. I guess we cap it off with Muspelheim and Suter, since we just talked about frost giants and whatnot.
Go ahead, Andre.
Well, yeah, this is more of Ian's topic. Okay, but basically, just to give a small gist of it, Muspelheim is just the primordial realm of fire, and Ian can take it from there.
Were you done with frost giants, though? I didn't want to cut you off.
Yeah, honestly, I don't have that much else to say about the frost giants, more that they are a typical description of a giant that rules the realm of cold, ice, rime, and so forth.
Right. All right, so as Andre said, Muspelheim is the realm of fire. And in this case, there's not really a description of it given like some of these other places in the lore. Honestly, I imagine it being kind of prototypically hellish, like a level from Doom or something, in that everything's on fire, everything is fiery. All of the Jotun from there are, you know, associated with flame. Logi is one we've already talked about, but then Suter is the most famous one. His name means black or the swarthy one in Old Norse, and he's the ruler or king of the Jotun in Muspelheim. So he is, I would say, you know, the most powerful and the grandest in a grand as in terrible kind of sense of the, you know, Jotun from that sense. He's like the fiery counterpart of Thrym. So he's mentioned twice in the Völuspá, where the first time is the Volva talking to Odin about the prophecy of Ragnarok. And she states that Suter will come from the south with flames carrying a burning sword. And the exact quote is from the 40th stanza, where she states, "Suter fares from the south with his scourge for branches, the son of the battle gods shone for his sword." And then he, after, you know, he enters the battlefield, so to speak, he and Frey find each other and they engage each other in battle. But in the Völuspá, it doesn't really actually talk about their fight itself. Like, there's no description of their actual battle the way Odin's devouring by Fenrir and subsequent revenge takes place, or like Thor battling the world serpent. It says that Beli's fair slayer, which is a kenning for Freyr, seeks out Suter, going to find his great, you know, destined foe. But Freyr, lacking his sword, because he gave it to his servant to win the hand of Gerd, his giantess wife, or Jotnar wife, he's presumably killed because after Ragnarok, after Suter's fire, you know, cleans the earth and it is reborn from the sea, green and new, Freyr isn't there. But neither is Suter. And given that most of these divine fated pairings, you know, of enemies, you know, Odin and Fenrir, Thor and Jormungand, et cetera, they all, you know, Loki and Heimdall kill each other, Tyr and Garm kill each other. They all seem these, you know, opposing forces take each other out, like, you know, unstoppable force, immovable object collide, and then nothingness until, you know, I mean, in a sense, that's almost what Ragnarok is. You know, these contradictory forces smashing into each other and then creating something new out of the destruction of the old. So given that, you know, Freyr and Suter meet their fate together, it is kind of a UPG, but I presume that Freyr slays Suter and Suter slays Freyr. So,
fair assumption.
I mean, if you guys disagree, I'd welcome to hear it, but I've never really seen anything that claimed otherwise.
No, I certainly, I you mean it happens all across the board. It's fair to assume as such, I would say. Well, and then obviously after, and then Ian mentioned, Baldur returns. There are a few survivors, and, you know, they talk about how there's going to be an age of kings and justice and you know, all of this stuff after Ragnarok, and it talks about how the world is green and new and beautiful and reborn, and it's prophesized, and it's a really fascinating topic to get into. But unfortunately, guys, we have ran out of time. Is there anything else that we'd like to conclude with?
Destroyer of the Universe by Amon Amarth is a really cool song about Suter, especially if you like Freyr, because you imagine Freyr like just owning this giant flaming douche, and it's cool. Check it out.
Yeah. And in conclusion, I would say people that claim to be what they call Rock-a-True or Thirsta-True,
those chumps, yeah.
These people are absolutely out of their minds, and they're just looking to become. They're literally just copying Satanism, is what they're doing.
Yeah, and they're fundamentally deranged. Like, as we've discussed, having sympathy for Fenrir is one thing, but then, as I've seen some cringe stuff, worshiping Fenrir as like a son of Odin and like the god of wolves is really cringe, a total UPG, and you should stop that. Just stop it.
It's ridiculous. There's zero historical evidence for anything even close to that.
And how twisted and broken does your mind have to be that your ultimate goal of existence is to return to primordial nothingness? It's literally Luciferian left-hand path occultist I want everything to end because primordial ooze is how we're all supposed to be. It's nonsense. It's utter nonsense.
It's like, why not just kill yourself?
Unironically, it's like, get a head start then. Go suck start a shotgun, dude. Like,
just
spare me your inane ramblings.
It's like having a picture on your wall, a picture of the revolver that you're going to put in your mouth eventually.
It's like listening to Nickelback.
I love it that bad. Come on. Come on, dude. Now you're
it's slightly better than listening to Nickelback.
So, unfortunately, that's going to be it for this evening. Fellas, excellent job. Excellent show. Excellent way to come back from our unfortunate sabbatical. But everybody, make sure to go to facebook.com/IronAgeJyotish and check out some authentic Vedic astrology. If you decide to go get a reading there, which I know you will, make sure to tell Mr. Neil John over there Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you. Also, if you support the Bog, you want to continuously help us keep the lights on and help us grow and everything like that. YouTube just demonetized us, man. Where more demonetization's coming. I know D-Live's going through some stuff. So I don't know where we're going to end up, but we will continue to be on the Patreon, and we will continue to make content for the folks over there. So go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. There's merch that comes along with it. You can get the RSS feed to listen to the audio of every single show that we do in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. patreon.com/thebog to support us. You can also support us by getting some merch. Go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. We got t-shirts, hoodies, all kinds of stuff, cups, whatever you can think of. There's hats, backpacks, phone cases, pillowcases, whatever you can think of is over there at shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. I also have some designs over there for my clan, so you can get a cool Skaferling Sipshaft shirt if you want to support my clan and help us grow and support what we do over there too. So shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop, and we'll be back next week. We got more content, exclusive content coming for Patreon, and I'll see you guys next Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, here in the Bog. Hail, many blessings, and much love to each and every one of the Bog Lords out there. Hail, I'll see you next week.